KaiserNetwork.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the 42nd President of the United States, William Jefferson Clinton.
Thank you. We are on schedule, and I want to stay that way. We've got a very exciting panel. It's a great panelist. But first, I want to introduce the next several commitments. The first involves an organization called Abraham's Vision. And I'd like to invite to the stage Gadi Kenny, Iman Batine, Shira Donna, Aaron Han Tapper, Gibran Bouyad. They have made a commitment to fund this program for the summer of 2006. And beyond teaching Jewish and Palestinian American students to analyze the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in new ways. Give them a hand. Yeah, that's for sure. This is quite important. The Abraham's Vision sent 23 university students to the former Yugoslavia this past summer. They were selected from six American universities known for tension between Arab, Jewish, and Muslim groups. They completed a four-week course there, analyzing the conflicts in Bosnia-Herzegovina, Kosovo, and Serbia. The course gave the students new tools to analyze religious conflict and to analyze the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in particular. So I thank them for this, and I hope that there will be more of this kind of thing. A U.S.-based scholar from Tel Aviv, Orly Friedman, said about the program that we're not here to say, okay, here is the ultimate solution. We want to create space for our students to explore these questions and their identities. So I would like to ask Gadi Kenny, Aaron Han Tapper, and Gibran Bouyad to come forward, and they can sign with me, and then we'll take a picture here. I have already signed, so you guys have to sign. Take the you take it.
Okay.
Come. Well, I'll take a picture. Thanks. The second organizations involve Brian Storm, the chairman and CEO of Marsh Insurance, Mindy Luber, the president of Ceres, Gus Speth, the Dean of the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies and a former valued member of the Clinton administration. I'd like to ask them to come up here. Their commitment is to create the Sustainable Governance Forum, a leadership development program that will prepare corporate directors for the business risks of climate change, commitment worth over $1 million over the next 4 years. The forum, with experts drawn from three distinguished member organizations, will educate over 200 board members from Fortune 1000 companies, teaching directors to assess and reduce the risk from climate change, educating them about new carbon reduction strategies and the significant business opportunities in managing these changes. The forum aims to publish the definitive guide for corporate directors on sustainable governance with real-world case studies that demonstrates successful climate conscious governance. This is a terribly important thing. There was a fascinating article in the paper just yesterday in America about how many European companies are doing a better job than American companies in offsetting the impact of business travel and other corporate activities, and how they expect to actually save money in the long run by implementing systems now in the most cost-effective way that will be less burdensome when the inevitable regulations from climate change come forward. So I thank you for doing this. I think this is really, really important. You should give them all a hand as they come up and sign their agenda. There you go. In the southern part of my state. Come on,
that's right.
60 years ago, and they stopped all the fertilizer in the 1800s. They got rid of it and went on to their first time. Bless you. The next commitment comes from the Foundation for Innovative New Diagnostics, acronym FIND. So I'd like to ask Giorgio Rossegno, the Chief Executive Officer, Sam Zaramba, the Director of Health Services of the Ministry of Health of Uganda, to come forward. The commitment of FIND is to help Uganda improve its medical diagnostic services through a program to kickstart the private sector. FIND will work with the African Medical and Research Foundation and the government of Uganda to draw up a status report on the country's lab capacity and to develop a plan to improve the system. It will create a model of social franchising, providing seed funding and startup equipment to Ugandan entrepreneurs who want to pursue diagnostic businesses, and develop a system of accreditation for the labs, a very important thing to do. The program will build infrastructure, improve services, and prepare the country to integrate new diagnostic tools in the future, and to create a model that we hope can be used elsewhere. This is very important. Uganda has about 28 million people, a life expectancy of just over 52 years, a significant problem, as all of you know, with HIV and AIDS. But the capacity, I believe, to develop an organized response to all of its various and many medical problems. So I'm very grateful, and I'd like to ask Mr. Rossegno to come forward and sign a commitment and give them a hand, along with the government of Uganda. We have just two more. First, I'd like to ask Malika Dutt, the Executive Director of Breakthrough, to come forward. Breakthrough has made a commitment to launch a U.S. multimedia education campaign, Value Families, to reduce hostility toward immigrants. Very important right here before this election, I might say. Encourage diversity and endorse fair immigration policy. In a campaign worth about $4.5 million over the next 3 years, the campaign will target young adults, produce a set of multimedia products that include a music video, monthly online podcast, public service announcements, and video games relating to immigration issues, framing these issues in terms of human rights, discouraging fear mongering that so often characterizes the immigration debate in our nation. Breakthrough will convene 4 public education forums in the first year of the initiative. The first is in New York this last week. It was co-sponsored by more than 70 other organizations. There will be other forums in Illinois, Georgia, and Texas. This is a very, very big issue for our country and indeed for the entire world. So I thank you very much. Malika, and I ask you to come forward and sign the commitment. And I know that the Starry Night Fund, I think, of the Tides Foundation is also helping you. So if anybody's here from the Starry Night Fund, they're welcome to come up and have their picture taken. You want to sign the commitment here? Give her a hand.
Thank you, President Clinton, for this extraordinary opportunity.
Now I'd like to invite to the stage Deepak Advani, the Chief Marketing Officer of Lenovo, John and Jackie Webberg, who are private donors, Chris Crane, the CEO of Opportunity International, former Ambassador of the World Food Organization, Tony Hall, and former Ambassador Mark Irwin, involved with the organization Opportunity International. They have committed to mobilize $500 million for financial services for 50 million poor people over the next 5 years. The $500 million for 50 million people campaign will provide loans, savings, insurance, and training to people working their way out of poverty in Africa, Asia, Eastern Europe, and Latin America. 60% of the 50 million recipients of this aid will be loan recipients and their family members. The other 40% will be those employed by the loan recipients or people who participate in opportunity, savings, and insurance programs. By 2010, 34 nations in Africa, Asia, Eastern Europe, and Russia, and Latin America, with a particular emphasis in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia, will be participating. Opportunity International is a world leader in developing insurance for the poor. It successfully piloted crop insurance in Africa with the World Bank in 2005. This is a big deal for those of us who are working on trying to raise farm income in rural Africa. And they aim to have a staff in all 34 countries by 2010. This is a very impressive thing. So I would like to thank all the people who are here. John and Jackie Weber recently made the largest gift ever to a microfinance organization when they gave $50 million to Opportunity International. The Lenovo Corporation is a leading coalition of tech firms supporting microfinance, has committed $1 million in computer hardware alone. And ambassadors Hall and Irwin are senior advisors to the campaign, and they were valued friends and members of my administration. This is a very impressive commitment, and I'd like to invite those who are here. And I don't know if Chris Crane, the president of Opportunity International, is here, but I'd like to ask them all to come up and sign this commitment, those of you who are involved.
Can we all sign up?
Yep, please go ahead.
Thank you so much. This is so exciting.
So we have 15 million people, 6 million last year, mobilized 80 million last year. So we're going to do this later.
Thank you.
Mr. Crane just said that they're not exaggerating. They helped 6 million people last year alone before they got all this big gift. They are going to make their 50 million commitment. So let's give them a big hand. So much. That concludes the afternoon's commitments. Now we're going to get on with the panel. Please welcome Ruth Simmons, the president of Brown University, the moderator for the next panel, and we'll get started. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Welcome to this session on effective action, lasting results. Of course, the purpose of this session is to focus our thinking on improving the collective efforts of NGOs, foundations, and private citizens in addressing difficult global challenges. We want to look at what has worked in the past and what might work in the future from the perspective of four individuals who have been at the forefront of identifying and addressing those very challenges. Our goal is to have them inspire you to look for the opportunities to work across borders, sectors, and institutions to identify promising approaches to solving these and other problems. And I know that if anyone can inspire you, this group will. So let me mention each of them very briefly and then move quickly to our opening session. Our panelists clearly need no introduction. I'll start with President Clinton. He's already on stage. Of course, you all know him as a uniter par excellence. Whether tackling aid for victims of disaster or bringing people together to address a worldwide epidemic, he draws on his phenomenal intellect and his lived experience of the other to demonstrate that boundaries can be crossed and hurdles scaled in the service of humanitarian causes. The body of his work and accomplishments continues to grow and accelerate as he demonstrates continually that in all matters of broad concern to the health and welfare of humanity, he is a giant among men. Now I want to ask the rest of our panelists to come out. Bill Gates. Of course, Mr. Gates is known as a brilliant innovator and visionary in the technological world, and he has brought that same energy and vision to philanthropy, and the world is already much the better for it. The Gates Foundation is setting new standards and levels of assistance in addressing global problems, and based on what we've seen thus far, we would be well served to hear his perspective and heed his insights on the challenges ahead. Fernando Cardoso. President Cardoso's career is the result of the spectacular interweaving of his experiences as a professor of sociology, an admired and effective head of state, and an enviably pragmatic spirit that many academics and heads of state would do well to emulate. A very distinguished academic, who I am proud to say is a faculty member at Brown, he has combined politics and reformism in a powerful way. We will want to hear his thoughts on combining philanthropy and politics in this increasingly polarized world. Hernando de Soto. Mr. De Soto's Institute for Liberty and Democracy is an important agency for economic modernization in Peru, across the face of Latin America, and increasingly all around the world. He brings important insights and great clarity to the factors that impede solutions in some countries. His work will offer helpful suggestions to those who are concerned about philanthropy in a sustainable context. So now, I'm going to pose a question for each of our panelists and request a response of 2 to 3 minutes to set the stage for the panel's discussion and interaction around these questions. Let's start with Mr. Gates. What have you found to be the 2 or 3 most pressing sources of inequity in the world that you believe could, through coordinated, effective philanthropy, actually be solved?
I think the greatest inequity, you have to start with health. That is, every parent should have their children be healthy, have a chance of growing up to be an adult. But all the inequities tend to be found together, whether it's lack of education opportunity, lack of agricultural productivity, lack of good governance in the area. And unfortunately, because these all correlate together, they tend to reinforce each other. That's the bad news. And if you think of 6 billion people, depending on how you measure it, there's something like 2 to 3 billion that are still in a situation where the positive cycle of improved conditions that we see in many countries is not happening. And so for those people, you know, the world is not yet flat in the positive way. The good news is that if you start dealing with these even individually, but ideally as a group, if you get more female literacy, if you improve health, that brings down the population growth, that allows there to be more resource available to take care of people. And so those are the really big ones that you get to some threshold where the fantastic things happens and levels of education, nutrition, job opportunities gets things going in the direction you'd like. And so, you know, it's a simple goal is to say that equity requires us to take those several billion and help them get it kick-started so that they have the same opportunity.
Great, thank you. Mr. Quentin, what do you think are the biggest issues that the world faces today, and how do you feel about our ability to address them?
Well, I think in the short term, the biggest problems are the ones that dominate the headlines. The violence, the upheaval, the dysfunction, the terror, the hatred based on religious, political, and other differences. But I would say in the medium term, medium to long term, the fact that half the world is not part of what brings us all here today, which is what Bill Gates talked about, whether it's education, health, or whatever, and the fact that global warming has the capacity, global warming and oil depletion combined have the capacity to change the conditions under which we all operate on this planet, the very assumptions by which you run Brown University and all of us do whatever we're doing and Hernando de Soto tries to get title to poor people, I think those are big challenges. And in terms of what we can do about it, I think, first of all, it's important for us to be disciplined here and to recognize what things must be dealt with solely by the state, the government, whether a national government, a local government, or a multinational organization. What things can be dealt with by a partnership between the state and the non-governmental sector. And I told Bill Gates on the way in here, it's my opinion that when President Cardoso was in the president of Brazil, he did a better job of employing the resources of the non-governmental sector than any other world leader that with whom I was personally acquainted. There was no better social entrepreneur in the position of running a country with challenges than he was. Thanks. And according to his book, it was because of his wife, Ruth, but for whatever reason, nobody did it better. So I think that's important. And the third thing I would like to say is we have to identify those things which where we can have a measurable impact. And in very different ways, that's what Mr. Gates and I try to do. You know, we try to say, when I was with Bill and Melinda Gates in Africa recently, I was blown away by the level of knowledge they had about treatment protocols, research options, and things in the efforts to develop not only an AIDS vaccine, but the microbicidal gel and other things. We have to know where we can make a difference and then concentrate our efforts there. Because we don't want to make the same mistake that I think is permeates both the short and the medium to long-term problems in the developing world, which is the total absence of capacity to reward intelligence and effort. If you think about it, almost every person here today followed whatever your life path here was, by believing from the time you were a fairly young age that there was a connection between the effort you made and the result you could expect. The real tragedy of abject poverty and terrible health care and life being basically a roll of the dice is that it breaks the connection between effort and reward. and life becomes apparently arbitrary and brutal. So I think that that's why I think what Hernando de Soto does is so important. We have to establish systems and build capacity and try to deal with both the short and the long-term problems and be disciplined enough to know what the government has to do and what we can do no matter what happens to government policy at home and around the world.
I'm sure people will want to come back to that and explore it further as we get into the other questions. Mr. Cardoso, we've just heard that you were a brilliant reformer as president of Brazil. You forged a close relationship between government and non-government organizations. So tell us, what is the role of such partnerships in addressing the kinds of issues that both Mr. Gates and President Clinton just identified?
Well, let me start by telling you a little story. Some years ago, when I was yet president of Brazil, I attended a Latin American summit of presidents. And at one point, one of the presidents said, well, let's make a meeting alone, even without foreign ministers, only presidents. And the main discussion was, well, who are the enemies of us? And normally the answer was, we have two main enemies, the press and NGOs. So it's difficult to convince people in government that the NGOs can help, as well as it is difficult for some NGOs to understand that it's necessary to go into partnership with government. A friend of mine, who is a professor of sociology, he's from Spain, named Manuel Castells, used to qualify some NGOs as new governmental organizations. Well, I don't like to go too far, but anyhow, some bridge between civil society and government is absolutely necessary in order to solve these problems. You see? And the first step is how to convince both sides, how to convince corporations that it's important to work together with the government, how to convince some CEOs, people used to have to command, to give orders, that in the political arena is not like that. You have to motivate people. It's not enough to give orders. So this is a pedagogical process, but it helps. I don't want to occupy too much time, but anyhow, in our experience in Brazil, this was possible to be done. I can give you some examples. Just to start with one example, HIV AIDS. When we discovered in Brazil that the HIV and AIDS was a tremendous problem, the disease was expanding in Brazil, some decisions have been taken by different parts of the Brazilian population, Brazilian sectors of the society. One was, well, let's organize people which are already infected to try to defend their rights. They did. Then some other initiatives in the Congress have been made to turn free the treatment, totally free, the medicine to deal with AIDS. Then we had to convince the finance minister that it is an enormous amount of money, but it deserved to be used to that proposal. Then we had to convince the public opinion about some very sensitive issues. For instance, the use of condoms in a Catholic country like Brazil. And the government took the decision to put it clearly, advertising, using TV, very crudely, you see. And what was the result of this partnership? NGOs, government, Congress, and even to convince the people that this is necessary to realize the importance of dealing with the problem and to avoid discrimination and stigma. The result was that in practice we stopped the expansion of the disease in Brazil. The treatment was dramatically reduced, not just because people start by being treated since the beginning, but also because the government made a tremendous fight against some pharmaceuticals. And at the end, we did a compromise, and we induced them to produce generics. So we reduced the cost for the treatment. So this was a very successful program. And now we are exporting the idea to other countries in Africa, so on and so forth. So it is feasible. We did. It's important. It requires strength. It requires the capacity to the leadership to convince people. That's my
head. Leadership. Terrific. Thank you. Mr. DeSoto, we have a room full of people here who are looking for very, very concrete measures to address some of these problems. You've come up with an idea that is absolutely brilliant, and one of the things we were talking about earlier is it's an idea that was hidden in plain sight, so obvious when we hear it that this is a very important concept. So what are some of the keys to lasting, sustainable change in these areas?
I think the short answer to that is the law. From the point of view of developing and former Soviet Union nations, we're about 5 billion countries in the world with access to your technology, but what we lack is the law. Not prohibitive law, but facilitative law. Already more than two centuries ago, Adam Smith, first in the 18th and then 19th, Marx, agreed on what was the key to this new modern industrial revolution that they were seeing, surge. And it was cooperation. They called it division of labor. What they didn't say, because it was too early on, was that division of labor, the possibility of outsourcing everywhere, of dividing labor in-house in hierarchies, requires to be brought together the law. It requires very concrete things to nail down agreements between people. That's what I see, for example, in this wonderful forum that President Clinton has organized. He's trying to get commitments. He's trying to nail things down. And in effect, if you see what happens generally in the market economy, we're all there. Make a pencil, you need graphite from Sri Lanka. To get wood, you need some from Oregon. To get the black nickel, you have to go to Nigeria. It's all there, the division of labor. The question is, who puts it all together? Who brings all these things together? Are the people who have got the legal tools to do so. How can you bring things together if you don't have an address? How can you have an address if you don't have property rights? That's where they're recorded. How do you identify yourself so as to get credit, credibility, if it isn't also through a property right? How do you get organized outside your family so you can have a hierarchy that is not that of your family unless you can actually put a company together? How can you actually get money to start off with if you can't issue shares, which happen to be rights over an intangible good, which is called the company? It's nothing specific, but where else is value brought up if it isn't in shares? How can you keep capital together if you can't shield the assets? All of these are instruments given by law. And we just finished a very interesting study where we were together with President Clinton and our friend Luis Alberto Moreno at the Inter-American Development Bank. And after doing a survey of Latin American countries, we found that in average, 95% of all Latin American companies or business organizations don't have any access whatsoever to any of the features I mentioned before. Any. In other words, lots of enterprises, because we call them enterprises, we call them family enterprises, micro enterprises, whatever it is, but none of them have got hierarchies, none of them issue shares, none of them can actually give an identification in the business world, not in the village, in the business world, where you need, even if you're going to get into the internet, you need some kind of an address. You need to be identified with a number, with a protocol. You've got to have rules. We don't have any of those. So what I'm saying, basically, is that we have not paid attention to things that link us. Your namesake, President Clinton, Thomas Jefferson, used to pride himself by saying, "I am a nail maker." Those were the days when Americans built cabins. And as they moved along, they burnt them to recuperate the nails, because there was nothing more valuable until we learned to cut wire. We don't have nails in most of the world.
Fascinating. I really want us to move through this series of questions, having each of you at will entering the conversation as you feel the need to, because I think we'll all benefit from your interacting a bit. So let me start again with Mr. Gates. tell us what are the appropriate roles for NGOs, private philanthropy, governments, markets, and individuals in solving some of these global problems?
Well, there are specialized capabilities for each of those entities. Governments are absolutely critical. The government on the ground, if you're really going to have a great success story, has to be stable, has to create property rights, education infrastructure. You know, the greatest success in eliminating poverty in the last 20 years is China. If it wasn't for what happened there, the world would actually have more people in abject poverty today than it did 20 years ago. And that is governmental action, you know, very enlightened government that has changed human conditions in a very dramatic way. So government, local government, will always be central. There are things that need to be done that are risky. For example, taking technology, coming up with drugs, say, to deal with the diseases that are only in these developing countries. And there it's essentially a failure of the marketplace, that there's no incentive for the companies who usually do that to go about it. And yet they're the ones with the right skills. And so how do you bring money to them? How do you take out some of the risk for them, create a structure to make it worthwhile for, say, a GlaxoSmithKline to work on a malaria vaccine? That's private philanthropy has to come in and do that, because it's risk-taking, it's organizing smart individuals in a way that probably is not appropriate for governments to do so. If you have a really bad local government, NGOs can step up and deal with some of the problems, but hopefully that's more of a short-term way of dealing with the situation than a long-term way. The United States is a great example of a country where the government is strong, and yet the NGOs are very complementary in what they do, probably as much here as in any country, and that's something that ideally will spread to be more global. So, to really solve these problems, I think we have to get every one of the actors to step up. In philanthropy, I'm very optimistic. I think there's a positive momentum, some visibilities of the impacts that can be had, some different ways of going about it, and events like the Clinton Global Initiative really are bringing visibility that helps drive that momentum. Governments, you know, we've got things like PEPFAR that we never had before. We've got vaccine fund. We've got the UNITAID effort, which is a substantial amount of new money. So we are seeing positive developments because people are hearing about the success. Getting voters to really think these are top issues. I often say, you know, are we going to have a presidential debate where developing country aid issues come up as a point of discussion? I think that'll be a nice milestone that will happen someday. But still a lot that can be done.
Terrific. President Clinton, you have, this is an extraordinary event. We all agree with that. What you're doing with the foundation is quite unique. So what are some of the keys of success in your programs? And describe a specific project, and then tell us what made it successful.
Well, first of all, I think that to follow up on what Bill Gates said and what Fernando Enrique Cardoso said about in Latin America, there was a lot of opposition to the NGOs. That's because some NGOs are advocates for public change. Some NGOs are deliverers of direct services. Some NGOs are working on partnerships with government. I think most of us are interested in the delivery business in some form or fashion. So what we did, and I was to, in the AIDS issue, we recognized that there were two things that we could do without a lot of money. I basically started out with commitments from the Irish and Canadian governments, and then one from the Norwegian government, and eventually the Swedes and the French and the British helped us in the Caribbean. But we went in and established agreements with countries and worked with national governments to develop systems to diagnose, treat, and care for people with HIV and AIDS. So that, in effect, we were trying to help them build up a health infrastructure. Again, because of what I said in my earlier remarks, but the absence of systems in so many low-income places. The other thing we did was to try to essentially reorganize the generic AIDS drugs market from a low-volume, high-margin, uncertain payment business to a high-volume, low-margin, prompt payment business to good effect. That was just a place where we had a certain amount of expertise that when other people guaranteed us the money to make it attractive to the producers, we were able to do it. I think there are many cases like that where someone, there's no doubt that in many ways the Gates Foundation has done similar things with all the various things it operates in. But one of the things that I would like to see is a well-funded NGO help to systematize the work that Hernando de Soto does. I worry about him. I'm always afraid we're going to lose him because he works so hard and he goes around to all these countries and nominally they want to be his partner. So they'll say, please do a study and find me how many, what percentage of my business is in old Cairo, as I remember, it's 85% of the businesses you found were in the informal sector. And so he'll do all these studies. It's highly labor intensive. Then someone has to stay behind until the laws are changed in the country and figure out what to do. And then with the work, we've done work in Africa where there are a whole different set of problems on this. But the point I'm trying to make is every NGO has to recognize what is the landscape here, what can I bring to it, and in the end, how will it go on if something happens to me or our crowd? That's why whenever you can work with the government, you're better off. And why we have to find ways to establish systems that work for people when we're not around.
Well, I think what President Clinton said is very important, and of course what all the fellow panelists, and including President Cardoso, in terms of why as a government got to protect itself from the press and the NGOs. But it's not only that, I mean, thinking about Latin America, Africa, Asia, well, most of the world, it's that literally we're finding out as we move into the 21st century, after we thought that with the fall of Berlin, the market economy was in to stay, that it's not that clear. But it's not that clear because it's not inclusive. It doesn't just happen automatically. There may have been an invisible hand, but it didn't work here. There's an anonymous hand, which still has to be put into place. When you go and you see what happens in every Latin American country, that's what our statistics are about, the people who can actually clinch a business deal, now that, for example, we're all in many parts of Hispanic America signing free trade agreements with the United States, and we try to calculate what amount of companies in Latin America can actually fill in a bill of lading, can fill in an airway bill, can just fill in the documents to go abroad, not because of knowledge, but because they've got the addresses, because they've got the identities, because they've got everything that indicates what their capital is. It's only 5%. So no wonder they're not jumping up and down because of their free trade. No wonder they're not jumping up and down just because the Berlin Wall fell. And it's not only a Latin American problem. It's also a Chinese problem. We're seeing that there are about 300 million Chinese that seem to be moving into the market economy. But there's 1 billion Chinese who just last year made over 85,000 revolts because they didn't feel included. So it's not that easy. And it's not going to happen until you get the instruments to work within a market economy. We always thought that a market was automatic. It's not true. You've done a lot of legal building in your countries, which has been imperceptible because you've only done it slowly. And some of it even recently. It's only about a century and 10 years ago that in the United States, the majority of your states had the right to incorporate legally without having a political act of Congress before. It started in 1810, 1811, and it gradually moved to Delaware and to New York and to California, and there first the textile industry, then another industry. But you only started getting it together about 110 years ago. And over the last 110 years, you Americans and Europeans have grown 28 times more than you had grown since Jesus Christ. Well, we've only grown 4 times more. The Industrial Revolution started with Adam Smith, even though he didn't recognize it, back in the 18th century. But you only got your legal act together 110 years ago. And we're going to be in trouble until, on the one hand, you realize that what you've got most precious, you really don't know much about, and what we need the most is a subject handled by people we don't like very much, who are lawyers.
Okay. Well, there you are.
Can I
But
I just want to follow up on this, because this is a very important thing in our hemisphere, but throughout the world. You mentioned the Chinese. And Bill is right. They've done a terrific job, I think, of managing the biggest mass movement of people, for example, in modern history, from the rural areas to the cities, and generating jobs. The Indians now have the biggest middle class in the world, but there's also a new violent revolt in the Indian countryside. The current government was brought to power in India because basically two-thirds of the people had not been touched by the elevation of the Indian economy. You see all over Latin America a reaction manifest in various elections, which you know well, to the developments of the global economy, because most people in those countries have not been affected by it. There's a big debate going on in America now about whether our people are net better off or not from all the trade deals and all of this. So is your take on this, I want to get to the bottom of this. This is a huge political issue in every country. Why did the Dutch and the French reject the EU Constitution? All this is going. Is it your belief that the reason the global economy is not working for at least half the people in Latin America, that they don't have the right titling system, the right access to credit, the right sort of legal systems, rather than global capitalism, just won't work for everybody without a more of a redistributive ethic among the governments? I think this is a very, very important issue, and it sets the environment in which all of us have to work.
Well, yeah, I do agree, but anyhow, I think there are some other basic rights which have to be also taken into account. Because it's not just the lack of the legal system. We don't have education. Illiteracy is still very high in some areas. Health. So you said before, you have to take it about the synergy. It's not possible to solve this problem without making the connections between the different levels of problems. In the case of Latin America, you know, illiteracy is still a problem. In my own country, in Brazil, we had lots of people that are not capable to read. Now all young Brazilians are enrolled in primary school level, but yet those who never have not had the same possibility in the past years, they have to be also trained. So that's why we organize a program by the Comunidade Solidária, Solidarity Community, I don't know how to say, who organize, and now they are training about, they did, 5 million adults in Brazil, which were not able to read. And how to do that? By asking, again, NGOs, universities, teachers. This was one of the NGOs organized by my wife when we were there, but this is at the level of civil society. So I do agree that the legal problem is very important, but we have also to take into account the other problems and tackle altogether. Otherwise, it would be impossible to have access to not just to the market, but to continue to survive, and it's a basic question.
If I may continue that, President Cardoso, it's obviously true. Nobody's got a silver bullet. That's quite clear. But let me tell you why I think the law deserves a lot more consideration than we give it so far. First of all, because very little people are actually involved in finding out why, in spite of all the legal transplants that began with imperialism, that continued after the First World War, that began after the Second World War, it hasn't caught on to the social order. So we're not talking about the law as is, we're talking about the law as genesis. Everybody knows what it looks like when it's working. Nobody knows how to make it catch the social order. Now let me tell you why I think that that's immensely important. Because the market economy, with the fall of the Berlin Wall, with the victories in the Second World War, has actually destroyed all other social organizations which existed in our countries before. A family that was strong and entrepreneurial. We've just finished in Tanzania a study with President Mkapa to find out how wide was the intervention of tribes in the production of the economy. It's only 10%. That's what's left, 10%. 90% is private business, albeit impoverished and illegal. And in Peru, it's about 80%. So in other words, if we have gone out and destroyed feudalism, which was a way of getting together, which was a way of avoiding disorder in the Hobbes style. That disorder, tremendous disorder that caused so many world wars. If we have destroyed patrimonialism, if we've destroyed the family as a center of production, we've got to hurry up to substitute the production units with what we have actually, with what for which there's a vacuum. And that's the reason people are arriving. When Latin Americans get awfully unsatisfied, they know where to go. They come to the United States. But when they have to try and get organized locally, they don't have the means to get organized.
Well, I'm not denying your point. What I'm saying is not enough to stress this point. We have to put together other points. And as you know better than myself, Latin America is extremely diversified. So you are referring to some countries in which patrimonialism is still very strange there, and also very, very, and also you have indigenous population. That's not the case in the Atlantic coast. I mean, in Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay. So we have different problems. We have the legal system is not, I know that it's an important problem, but not that crucial question as it could be in other areas. And I would say these other problems are more dramatic, have more priority. But let's repeat again and again. I'm not saying that's not important. What I'm saying is we have to look, you know, as a whole, the question in order to have developed. And And also I think that what has been done in China, for instance. In China, they have enormous amount of investment. So to solve the problem of poverty, we need NGOs, education, good health, a legal system, and investment altogether. And this will require also leadership, good government, and relationship between the private sector and the government, and to enforce law. Without enforcing law, it will be impossible to have investment. So this is a circular argument. I'm not against. I'm taking another point of the circle.
That's terrific. I'm going to intervene here and just bring us back to, I think, what the general interests of the audience might be with regard to this subject. And at a pragmatic level, for those who are thinking about these various connections and how to make them work, how to solve problems, we're still trying to offer advice to them about what they can look forward to, what they can, the ways that they can innovate in the way that you have innovated, for example. So let's go back to that for a bit and try to answer the question that President Clinton raised about what comes after your project. What do we do about that, Mr. Gates? And what do you look for when you're considering proposals for your foundation in terms of that sustainability?
Well, our foundation has a particular focus on global health as the first really big thing that we did about inequity and now some of the global development issues. And I think people do have to specialize. The good news is that some of these interventions are incredibly sustainable because of the positive development that comes out of when you lower the birth rate, you get more female literacy, you get better productivity, you get better governance. Those things come together. And so people should feel fine to pick something, whether it's sanitation or crops or education, and know that it's, you know, one of the four or five key things that can drive a society towards the great place we want it to be. In our case, we particularly picked these 20 diseases that cause most of the difference between why people die in developing countries and not in the United States. And you can read the headlines all the time, and I don't think you get a sense of the 10 million children who die a year that shouldn't die, because it's one at a time. If a plane crashes in India, you'll read an article, but that same day, 50 times as many people died of diseases that should have been cured a long time ago. And so as you go out and visit these areas, you know, that's always the an important element of coming up with a giving plan, is to go out, meet some of the people doing work in the field, see the conditions, and feel a personal connection to what's going on. And I think that no one comes back and says, well, I don't want to be involved and give to that. But that visceral feeling, the facts behind the statistics that just really aren't talked about a lot, is there on the ground.
Mr. Clinton, I wonder if you would answer the question that you ask. What do you see as perhaps some practical measures of ensuring that Mr. De Soto's work is going to be followed up in the various countries where you're involved?
Well, I think the most important thing for those of us who are in the NGO community is whenever possible, we should be working with governments, and whatever it is we're doing, if it makes sense, we should hope it will be adopted by the governments in the country we operate in, because most of us are either going to run out of money or time or both. You know, some people, there may be a few of you that won't run out of money, and we're all going to run out of time as far as we know. So I think what we our whole goal ought to be to have made a contribution to the places we work that will be not only of enduring value to the particular lives we touch, but to the, again, I say, the capacity of the country. I know I sound like a broken record, but if you just think about your own life, going back to your childhood, all the lessons you were taught, wherever you were, how did you get to this room in the seat you're sitting in today? You, Ruth Simmons, have an astonishing life story. But in spite of the challenges your family faced, you were taught lessons that there was a connection between the efforts you made and the results you could expect, right?
Right.
Okay. And against all odds, you did it. Now, the problem, the reason that you, to create that set of order, that sort of orderly world, you can do like the Chinese have, where you have people whose habits and culture are kind of by nature entrepreneurial, but they mix well with centralized government decision making and all the things that are done to get order and investment and everything. And in various ways, all the Asians, most of the Asians have done quite well. If you want to do it from the bottom up, then you have to go back to something Hernando said. If you want to launch it totally from the bottom up, yes, I agree, you need education and health care and literacy and all that, but you have to have a system that works for individual initiative, which is quite different. And the problem we've got in poor areas in the United States and in much of Latin America is that we could never do it the Asian way because we're too independent, we don't organize ourselves in that way, but we don't have the systems which reward a sufficient number of individuals for taking that action. That's why I think what De Soto is trying to do is really important in certain cultures, and I think it'd make a huge difference in the Middle East, too, in a lot of the Arab countries.
Do you want to follow up on that?
Yes, of course. I think there's something very important to look at. It's first of all, look at your own success in the United States. 85 to 90% of all of you work in companies. That is to say that you're organized in a certain way, in a certain hierarchy that sometimes you don't look at because you're into your management courses, but you forget what kind of a shell you've actually built to be able to connect, to cooperate in a specific area. Secondly, when you deal with your own poor, like, for example, Alaska, your so-called Eskimos, and you had to put order there because you wanted also to get oil out, and also that's where you have a great quantity of your armed forces, now you've got them all incorporated, and they're some of the wealthiest people in the world. So the question would be the following one. It is to of indigenous people. The question would be the following. What do you actually do when you want to get people ahead? And then apply the same sort of conclusion to us, because it's a useful argument. Secondly, this actually transcends cultures. You know, in my country, we had a president called Alberto Fujimori, whose family came from Japan in the 1930s, along with about 1 million other Japanese families who went to two Latin American countries which welcomed Asians with open arms, Brazil and Peru. They were the only ones. And the reason Alberto Fujimori came to Peru and the Yoshiyamas went to Brazil was because they were poorer than we Latin Americans. Japanese growth is after the Second World War, when you started putting companies into place and property rights. It didn't happen before. Sure, you had elites like we do in Latin America. I mean, there is about 5% or 10% of Latin Americans who will understand 80% of the jokes on Saturday Night Live. I'm talking about all the other 80, 90%.
Is that the test?
For me, it's a test because I have a hard time sometimes. So what I'm trying to say is don't get fooled by appearances. There's a westernized elite
in every third world country, in every Soviet country, and they also have access to enterprise. The ones who don't are that 80% for whom we have created a separate legal sphere, like micro-enterprise. It's as if you found little skinny people in every country and said we've got to give them little suits, little ties, little shirts, but not the same rights we do.
Thank you. I have to say, which I love as a university president, we're learning a lot here. We have now gotten down, unfortunately, to the final moment, and I'm going to ask you very briefly, based on the discussion we've heard this afternoon, to offer final words of advice to conferees, again, about programs that they might initiate or efforts they might join that would make a difference on one of the issues that you've heard about or that you've spoken about tonight. So why don't we start with you, President Cardoso?
I think that the main question is to motivate people. It's not possible to do anything without passion. If you don't have the sentiment, you have to move, you have to do something, it's impossible. So I think what is important regarding the relationship between NGOs or civil society and government is to motivate people and to be concerned with. And this is the big advantage that NGOs have. Because NGOs, they can concentrate in some specific areas. And government has to be much more universal. We have to combine the effort by government universalizing the experience and the motivation by NGOs and the fact that some people devote themselves to solve specific and important problems. I believe that this is the important because NGOs could be much more innovative. And since they can produce innovation, then the government can absorb innovation and generalize the innovation. So I think this is the main challenge you people have to face. What do you feel? Are you concerned about what has been said, the lack of rights, the lack of law, the lack of health, education? So what in you specifically in your field, in your experience, how do you feel you can be cooperative? How can you help as individuals too? Because this is important, as we said, as a person. So this is the main difference between the bureaucracy in government and NGOs and philanthropy, because philanthropy is highly motivated by one individual person, a people, and people will start by moving other people, and this produces a kind of a wave of goodwill. And without this goodwill, government became more and more bureaucratic. On the other side, if the government are not together, the goodwill will be not enough to solve the global problems of each society. I would suggest for the Clinton initiative, why not to organize a small group of people across the world who know already several experience and to classify what we know about health, about education, how can we behave, how can we behave in terms of how to empower people. There are lots of experience. Why not to have a small group making a screening what is okay or not, just not to waste the time of those who have goodwill but don't have enough experience to produce results. If you join goodwill with experience, the results will come.
Terrific.
My
Thank, you. Thank you. I want you all to share my pain. So if you look down there, you'll see a clock, and it says 0:00. So let that influence the length of time that you use. So, Mr. Gates.
Well, over the last 100 years, innovation and invention are the things that have really changed the world. And so to me, a lot of this is taking those innovations and making sure they can apply to everyone. And that's often harder than we think. You know, we invent AIDS drugs, and they work well in the rich world, but the cost, the approach, isn't going to work in the rest of the world. And yet, the rich world is where the expertise is. So bringing those innovations and putting them in a form that can be applied globally, that's where people can make such a difference. And not, you know, it doesn't, in many cases, take huge amounts of dollars. It takes ways of organizing people, pilot projects. And that's why I think the variety of people here at this event is such an exciting thing, because they'll go out and try hundreds of different things. Some reasonable percentage will work. People will see that and build on it. You know, so I think it takes many different things. Laws, property laws are a very helpful thing, but, you know, we had those 100 years ago. If we don't have the innovation, including things like health, bringing the population growth down, I think those are also key elements. And so that, you know, I'm very optimistic if we think of all this innovation and applying it broadly.
Terrific. Mr. DeSoto, I'm going to give President Clinton the final word, so if you would go next.
Yes, of course, I'll be very brief. You know, we formed in the United Nations a high-level commission on the empowerment of the poor to deal with legal problems, and with President Cardoso, we're on it. It's a commission that I co-chair with Madeleine Albright, and it's looking at these issues, so it's begun the fight to keep on growing. I'd just like to just shoot a couple of more examples that may be useful in this sense. I just read recent statistics that only about 5% of Mexicans who migrate to the United States are really considered poor. The majority of them are actually middle class and up, who are not missing more income, they're missing more organization. So I think it's very important to understand that just like in the 19th century, you had people like Darwin trying to find out how life generated. And they started coming down with the idea that it was a warm little pond with amino acids and electricity. And that was a huge enlightenment to then see how cells interconnect and how complex systems are organized. The time has come for more research and finding out how you actually got to where you got. Getting it outside the cultural stuff, it's because we're Anglo-Saxons, it's because we got more German blood. Come down to the facts. What tools did you have that we don't have? And there's very little research done on that.
Terrific. Thank you. President Clinton.
The specific response to your question, what can you learn from this about what you might do in the NGO world as citizens of the world? In a sentence, I always tell people, we live in an interdependent world that is unequal, unstable, and unsustainable, but good for us. We should try to create an integrated world of equal opportunity, shared responsibilities, and common membership in the human community. To do that, what do we learn from this panel? First of all, I advise you to look for countries that welcome NGOs as partners and to try to be partners with government, as Fernando Henrique Cardoso did in Brazil. That way, your work lasts in the work of the government you leave behind, whether your NGO stays or not. Secondly, I advise you to look for ways to change the system to empower people to help themselves, the way property rights do, or the way we did by changing the way the drug market works. Third, and perhaps most important, I urge you to try to find a way to innovate in the way that the Gates Foundation has done, as no one else has done, really looking at a cold-eyed view of the facts of these health challenges they face. They're not naive, but they're passionate. And they have a remarkable combination of spending money in ways where it's likely to have an immediate return if people do the right things on the ground, and investing in things that are likely to solve the problem over the long run, even if there's not a guarantee of a quick return, like the vaccine or the microbicide. So those three things represented by these people on this panel, I think, offer guidance to people in the NGO world, whether you're working on poverty alleviation or health problems or education or climate change or whatever. They've all been great, and I hope we can all be more like them when we grow up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.